I learned from my time with living with a lot of indigenous cultures that you move from fear, which is a good thing because it mm-hmm. teaches you, whoa, you know, mm-hmm. watch out. And then once you, if you can't run or fight, then fear moves into courage. You have to take action in some way.
Right.
But courage can burn you out if you keep having to use it. Courage is mm-hmm. an emotion, right? And right. I see that at Standing Rock, where I did 4 tours of duty. I saw a lot of my friends with a lot of courage, but then each time, you know, that something.
And fried them. Yeah.
Well, Indian people move into fearlessness. And they say, use the courage to decide whether you're going to make the action.
Right.
Once you take the action to love, for example, mm-hmm. you trust the universe.
Welcome to Came Here to Love, a podcast hosted by me, Liz Logan, where we explore heart-centered conversations with visionary leaders from around the world. This podcast is a journey into wisdom, a path to transformation, and an invitation to catch the highest vibration of all, love, elevating our lives and connecting us more deeply to ourselves and the world around us. Our mission is simple: to live with passion, align with purpose, and spread more love. In each episode, we invite compassionate leaders to share insights, personal breakthroughs, and heart-inspired ideas that impact change, not only in our own lives, but also in our communities and the world beyond. Whether you're seeking new perspectives, deeper connection, or a sense of purpose, Came Here to Love offers transformative insights that inspire, enlighten, and remind us all why we're here to love. Today on Came Here to Love, I sit down with Four Arrows, aka Don Trent Jacobs, PhD, EdD, former Dean of Education at Ogla Lakota College, and the author of numerous publications on decolonizing and pre-colonial Indigenous worldwide restoration. He was selected at one of 27 visionaries in education by Arrow and is a recipient of the Moral Courage Award from NAU's Martin Springer Institute for his pro-Indigenous activism. Retired from university life, he now offers 4-day trainings on how to master self-hypnosis, spiritual awareness, and kinship worldview with his cat-fawn connection. He lives and plays music in the beaches of Mexico. Well, so this is Came Here to Love, the podcast, and why it's called Came Here to Love. I named it intentionally that. It actually came to me in a meditation, and it was really about what is our purpose? What are we really doing here on this planet Earth, traveling in these beautiful human Earth costumes and running around, learning everything that we need to learn? And really what Came Here to Love is about for me is learning that we all are the essence of love. This is who we truly are. And when we rise into the vibrational frequency of love, which is the highest vibrational frequency there is, how it completely transforms us from our personality ego self into our soul self, our true essence, our higher selves. And so this podcast is really just an invitation of inspiring conversations with people I love around what it actually means to be in the presence of love and what that looks like and how that flows, whether it's, you know, I've sat down with a lot of people in the creative arts and how that's showing up in their work. I've sat down with a lot of leaders and how they're leading from a place of love to, you know, do major, major things in their lives. And so it's just a really fun playground for me to have amazing humans and to tell stories that need to be told and to give us a guiding light. You know, for me, it's like a lighthouse that brings us back to our heart. That's what we're doing here.
Can I offer a slight modification?
Of course. I love your interpretation.
How the Lakota and most indigenous cultures look at, they would love the title of your podcast, To Love. And then they would say, oh, and I was saying this as you were saying it, every time you used the noun love, they would have asked you to make it an action word also.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no, in like Lakota, there's no word for love, but there's like, I don't know, there's a lot of words. I can't guess the numbers. It could be 50, 60, but there's a whole lot of words for the action of love.
Mm.
So in the indigenous world, the language itself on indigenous languages, they're verb based. The majority of the words would be adjectives and verbs, where most of our European languages are noun-based. And if we look about the tragedies of love as a noun in the world, right? And you know, all of the things that happen because of love that wind up being horrible, you know, killing your lover or whatever, right? Love is a mixed bag. But the verb of actual loving, which is in the title to love, is really where Indigenous people are. And it may not be make a difference.
No, it's a huge difference. It's all about, you know, I think that our world thinks of love as a possession, as an actual tangible thing. And that's not the love we're talking about here.
I don't love, darn it.
Yeah. And this expectation around love, you know, I give you love, you give me, I expect something back in return. That's a transactional part of love. That's not what we're talking about. What we're really talking about is, to your point, is the action of what it is to be inside of love as love. And so how you move through that. So anyways, it's perfect that we have you here because you are an embodiment of that. And also with the Lakota, I feel like I would love to give everybody, the audience, a background of your connection with the Lakota and even your Cuatro Flechas name. Like, let's just talk about, how did you get to this moment where you are four arrows and you're very connected to the Lakota?
Well, thank you for the question. I am Donald Trent Jacobs by my birth name, my Anglo name. It's an Irish name. And I had just got back from Ireland and saw the 12 giant stainless steel feathers that during the potato famine, which was a forced genocide by Great Britain, there was the Shoshone tribe donated, I think it came out to be something like $55 or $155 in 1935, you know, during they, mm-hmm. and recognizing that it was the kind of thing that had happened to them. And it was that monument there. And I really, and then we went to the mass graves of the children. So I'm proud of my Irish name, Donald Trent Jacobs. But after the Marine Corps in 1969, I had a chip on my shoulder about the lies of Vietnam. And I took it out by doing whitewater adventures and wild horse training and races. And
I didn't know any of that. That's amazing.
One of my books, it's called Primal Awareness. And you can see it's got a Tarahumara, Mexican Tarahumara. Ah. And then this down here at the bottom is the 8,000-foot canyon called Copper Canyon. That's deeper.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Well, there was a river in it, the Rio Urique. Yeah. And I was working on my first doctorate as a firefighter with David Carr. And I said, we can be the first to ascend this river. Nobody's ascended it. You know? And he said, yeah, there might be a reason for that. I said, oh, we can do it. Find out. So we hired two Tarahumara Indians, and this book is about that. And at first, the water was doing well. It was about 1,500 cubic feet. It was beautiful, and we were, like, excited and enthusiastic. But we had to portage a lot because of these huge rocks where there was just not enough water. And we had to take we had inflatable kayaks, and we had to take our bags out of them, untie them. And it was a hassle. So I said, if we could just have a little more water, this would be Class 3 and Class 4 rapids. This would be wild. And David and I agree that it was within a minute. The thunder came, the lightning came, the clouds came.
Wow.
Pouring down rain, and it didn't stop. Got to be way over my skill level. We estimate 4,000 cubic feet per second.
Wow.
As we came into a canyon that went straight up with the rocks, maybe 1,000 feet, no getting out of the water. And I was scared. And yet we had to stop and our take turns climbing these wet boulders, holding a rope so we didn't to see, you know,
you were up against. Yeah.
See what was ahead of us, mm-hmm. because it could be Niagara Falls. It was an untrucked river. And so it was my turn to do it. And I'm going, oh God, I don't want to try to get off on this rock and the waves. And then I looked to my left and I saw this huge reverse eddy, and I went, oh, thank goodness, I'm in luck, man. I'm going to do this one. And so I pulled into the eddies, because in eddies, you can usually look down and see the
what's there. And take a time out. It's like rest point.
And go, okay. Yeah. And then I could tell Dave, come on in, we'll go river right, you know?
Right.
It wasn't a reverse eddy. It was the entire Rio Urique waiting to go into a hole about this big in the base of a giant boulder. And I could see the leaves going in it.
Oh my God.
And so as soon as I was up against a thing, and my boat got pulled out up against a flat, straight up rock. And I turned around and I'm trying to paddle back and I couldn't. And I remember David got up on a rock and our eyes met. And I kind of yelled, "Do not come, it's bad," you know, and I'm going out. And then bingo, my boat got stuck in the hole and the middle of it was too wide to go in and the water was just pounding under me. And I saw a hole that was going up through this boulder that was just big enough for my shoulders. And I thought, maybe I can get up and stand up and squeeze into it. So I put my hands on the rock. And as soon as I put my hands on the rock, I felt, I can't describe how beautiful of a powerful feeling I felt just as the boat flipped. And then I went down and in, and I had a near-death experience.
Wow.
And I saw a kind of a light. I was kind of had my hands up here as I was falling through this thing to just keep my head from getting hit, right? And I saw this light that I can't describe its beauty. I heard kind of a music I can't describe. I saw ancestors dead and alive and enemies and friends, and it was all beautiful, just beautiful, beautiful. And we estimate about 2 minutes later, I came out because I did come out, of course, and I came up on top and Dave dropped me down into that hole. I punctured the boat and it took about 2 minutes for the boat to come out. So long story short, the book talks about this trip. And if people go on YouTube, they can put in The Shaman's Message, Part 1, 2, and 3, and you'll see all my little, we had four little camera and we had shots of the entire first trip. And then I went back afterwards because it changed my life. I had been adopting wild horses. And if you go on YouTube and put in wild horse hypnotist, you'll see me when I was a young man on a television program where they wanted me to demonstrate my work with wild horses. I couldn't do any of that before the near-death experience.
Wow. It connected you to the deeper realms.
I worked 15 years on what happened to me about three nights after. Right after we were there, we knew that this was too dangerous to continue on, but we didn't know how to get out. And I saw a big crack in that canyon wall. And I said, "Dave, I think that's a cave." So, man, we pumped up my boat and we shot into right straight across into that cave and got in. Sure enough, it was a cave about 40 feet tall with three ledges. And the first night on the first ledge, by morning, water was up to us and we had to go up to the next ledge. The next night it was up to us and we had to go to the final ledge that if it came up again with the same frequency, we would drown. But a lion walked with our sleeping bag and we were on this thin ledge and it walked right over the side of our sleeping bags. And
a lion.
It's called an onza. It's a rare Mexican lion called an onza. And we smelled it and we felt it. And, you know, we were like a couple of kids after it went through. I go, "Did a freaking lion?"
Yeah. Like, did that really just happen?
Yeah. And then Dave said, "It's a way out." So we got out. Then on the trip, we're climbing up these broncas and getting lost in them. They dead end over these great divides. A young Taro Humara kept showing up and marking the trail for us. And one day he had a dead fawn on his back. Feet were bleeding. He had actually, they're great runners. And he had run it down because the feet on the rocks, he had just run it down and then knocked it out and was taking it back to his community for food. The next night, I had a vision of that cat, the mountain lion, and that fawn turning into neon lights in New York City. I think cat fawn. And for 15 years, I was obsessed with trying to understand what cat fawn meant. And again, long story short, if people can Google cat fawn, Michael Fisher's work on it. Michael Fisher is a doctor who specializes in fear. He wrote this biography about me called The Fearless Engagement of Four Arrows. And it's all about cat fawn. Cat is self-hypnosis, essentially. It's concentration activated transformation. Fawn is fear, authority, words, and nature. And what I learned from living when I came back and went down to the thing is that this hole has one big hole and about seven small holes. And over the millennia, the rocks would fill up the main hole and work on the smaller one. The Augustine Ramos, a 102-year-old shaman that I lived with when I went back, said that in the old days, when somebody was a prospect for becoming a medicine person, it would be put into the river before the canyon steepens, and would have to go through that.
If
they were afraid and they just moved in fear, they would go into one of the channels that would get stuck them into the hole that couldn't go through.
Wow.
But if they were relaxed, they would go right through, which is what happened to me, right? And so that changed my life. And I went back. I quit everything I was doing as a sports psychologist, sports hypnotherapist. And I went back to get my second doctorate. And I did my dissertation, which that book is. It's on the cat-fawn connection and primal awareness. Because I lived with the Robert Murray and I saw the power and the magic and the beauty.
Yeah.
Living there. And so looking at the indigenous worldview aspect of fear, which is very different than the colonial dominant one.
Mm-hmm.
In essence, in a brief thing, because it's a 2-week seminar otherwise, fear in the indigenous way, once fight or flight is, not an option.
Right.
It's an opportunity to practice a virtue, courage, patience, compassion, fortitude, humility, honesty. Whereas in our dominant world, we just freak out. We avoid fear when it does come, and whether we can't fight or fly, we just cry and just go crazy, right?
And I think I'm gonna stop you for a second there and inject this, because this is what we were talking about before about love, like all of those things that you're talking about. When you're in compassion and you're in peace and you're in understanding and you're in all of the words that you just mentioned, that's love. That's the expression of love. That's how love expresses itself. And on the opposite side of that coin is fear, right? And so it's like we're either in love or fear, one of the two, and everything deviates from those two. So I just wanted to kind of bring that together because of this conversation.
What a beautiful footnote. By the way, yeah. Michael had 150 footnotes in his book for each chapter, just like that. Just like that one, and they're brilliant. And that's a brilliant way to actually, help that a whole week of understanding that, right?
Yeah.
And Gandhi said, and I didn't know this until I read his book, because he uses a lot of references to support how fearlessness it is. Mm-hmm. Gandhi said that fearlessness is a prerequisite for spirituality.
Mm.
Now, most Western scholars say fearlessness is foolishness. But I learned from my time living with a lot of indigenous cultures that you move from fear, which is a good thing because it teaches you, watch out. And then if you can't run or fight, then fear moves into courage. You have to take action in some way.
Right.
But courage can burn you out if you keep having to use it. Courage is an emotion, right? And I see that at Standing Rock, where I did 4 tours of duty. I saw a lot of my friends with a lot of courage, but then each time,
fried them. Yeah.
Well, Indian people move into fearlessness, and they say use the courage to decide whether you're going to make the action.
Right.
Once you take the action to love, for example, you trust the universe.
Yeah. And you use the elements: the earth, the water, the fire, the air, and the ether. You use these elements as the great tools of mastery around being fearless. Right. And so
that's beautiful. Yeah. And that's the spirituality that we're talking about, because the spirit has to relate to it. It has to be part of the picture. And then the next one is authority, and dominant worldview. Essentially, authority comes from the Papa, the Pope, the priest, almost everything outside of us. Right.
Yeah.
And especially during the first 5 years of life, most of our troubles come from the hypnosis that was negative from our upbringing.
Right.
And so in the indigenous way, authority, the word chiefs didn't exist. That's a colonial name for people that were respected in the communities. There was not the hierarchy. It was a non-hierarchical balanced system. And the only authority was honest reflection on your lived experience.
Mm.
And then words.
The wisdom.
Yeah, the wisdom. And the words were sacred. Dr. Tom Goldman wrote a book called A Time Before Deception, in which he talked about how the indigenous peoples, when they first had treaties broken, would pray for the person who broke the treaty that they must have a mental illness, not to be able to describe reality. That was just in the beginning. And so when you're doing CAT, concentration activated transformation, you use it to go back and find out, why do I think what I think in ways that are getting me in trouble or give me optimal. And you, or you go back and see how you can, you know, where it came from, on whose authority. But then you use it to change. Indigenous ceremonies, the Anipi ceremony, they yeah. knew that animals and people go into a place where they go in, they don't know, they didn't have the terminology of right. brainwave frequencies, but they knew that you go into a certain place and you pray for being more generous. You pray for having
it's
more
intention. Strength. It's all intentional.
Intention and, yeah. and imagination.
Yes.
The two combined, right? And then, yes. of course, the last one is N, fawn for nature. And that is, what have you done to use nature as a teacher, right? And anyways, mm-hmm. so that's the kind of work that I do. And now that I'm no longer affiliated with universities, I'm starting to teach cat fawn.
And I love that.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll have to teach that out together. I would love to be a part of that and bring people to this magical place in Mexico that we both reside and do something.
We'll put on a co-presentation conference.
Yes, it would be so fun. And actually, one of the things that I love doing with you the most is the Temescal that's in your home that you so honorably open to community every Sunday night. And I've gotten to sit in that beautiful space with you and just witness your transmission of teachings and wisdom. And I just so appreciate, you know, I think we're at this very pivotal moment in life where we're so externally focused. The world is so out there and it's not at all about the internal world inside, I always say, inside the privacy of our own hearts. And so there's a lot of disturbance. There's a lot of imbalances. There's a lot of depression. There's a lot of, you know, angst. And when I really think about what you're doing in the world, it's bringing the indigenous wisdom back into the forefront of what we all need to remember as. And I feel like you're almost like you are a wisdom teacher for sure, but you're holding the torch to this wisdom bank of knowledge, if you will, that you're making sure it stays alive. And this is what I appreciate the most about what you're doing in the world is we're losing the essence of those wisdom teachings. And right now we're being called into this, it's a 20-year cycle of truth that we've just stepped into from an astrological standpoint. And it's asking us to question everything. It's asking us to question all of the things that we've been taught, all of the things that we've been shown, and what your work and all of your books are doing is it's bringing us back to that truth and back to the wisdom teachings of the world. And as you said, learning from nature and using our internal intuition and creativity to really be powerful beings in an authentic way.
Beautifully said again. And you know, and indigenous people are losing it. I've got a number mm-hmm. of Navajo students who tell me that 80% of the Navajo Nation, 80% have lost the language, lost the motivation to do ceremony, and have moved into Western religions, and that are more colonized, that don't have the sense of interconnectedness, unless you go deep. The founders probably did, you know, but the politics of the people that continue organizing it don't. And so it is being lost. The largest study ever done on biodiversity, it was the United Nations Biodiversity Report of May 2019, on a paper of every, you know, front page of every paper in the world, but only for a day because it was pretty scary. 1 million species of everything going extinct in a generation, 60% of the mammals having been gone in the last 100 years, etc. But I read the whole report and I found seven times in it, they said things like, and this is a direct quote, however, where indigenous worldview, and that was the phrase used, mm-hmm. operating and people have some control of the land, this extinction rate is non-existent or severely reduced. And I went, oh my gosh, this is what I've been saying. So I wrote an article for The Nation. And people can look at it on Google. It'll come up right up if they just put in Four Arrows, The Nation. And the name of the article was The Media Missed an Important Message in the UN Biodiversity Report. So, you know, I make a distinction between indigenous place-based knowledge. This is sort of a disclaimer for your audience.
Yeah.
Place-based indigenous knowledge requires complete fluency in the language and in the ceremonies and many generations in one place knowing the flora and fauna. We got to fight for that. We got to fight for their sovereignty on that. And there's not many people yet in the United States or Canada or Mexico with it, but around the world, we've got to support that. However, the worldview that they share in common belongs to everyone. And so, if people think, "Oh, I don't want to be doing," some good people don't want to misappropriate indigeneity. They can look at this idea and go, "Wow, we've got to be an ally for bringing that back."
Just like 100%, 100%. And you know, you've written so many books on all of these topics. So we're going to link a few of them down below. But what if someone wanted to just jump into your world? What book would you recommend they start with? Because you've written, haven't you written over like 20 books at this point? I mean, you're constantly writing.
Well, this is them right there on the shelf, the whole top shelf.
Yeah, it's like a whole library over there.
Yeah, I got about 24 books and I don't know, 100 chapters. And I don't want to talk about how many articles and peer review papers. But you know what I would, I don't know if this is something you want to do or not, but I put together to do exactly what you said for people, to give them, to let them jump in and see what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. I put together a 2-minute, 47-second video. Mm. And then I had a partner of mine in Great Britain put amazing images with it. And I just kind of stood up and gave the 2-minute, 47-second thing. But it turned out that UNESCO used it to close their sustainability conference 2 years ago.
Amazing.
There it is.
The earth is suffering. Climate change, pollution, and pandemics are some of the consequences of human-created assaults on our world. According to the United Nations Biodiversity Report, 1 million more species face imminent extinction, including us. We must live on Earth differently, if not for ourselves, for future generations. 80% of global biodiversity now exists on only 20% of the Earth. It is no coincidence that this small amount of land is mostly managed by indigenous cultures. According to 450 multidisciplinary scientists, extinction rates have been less severe, are avoided entirely in these areas held by indigenous people. We can all learn to live with greater respect for our non-human life forms. This is possible if we embrace the worldview that has guided us throughout our existence on this planet. In contrast to the dominant worldview, the indigenous one truly emphasizes our relationship to the land, the environment, and all its interconnected inhabitants. Without remembering this oneness with all of life, we are doomed. Regional and global scenarios currently lack explicit considerations of the indigenous worldview. It is also important that we do our best to protect and support the remaining indigenous cultures. They are fighting against all odds to protect the last of Earth's biodiversity. And while doing this, we can all re-embrace the worldview indigenous peoples share. We can come to understand that human relationship with nature is a continuous two-way dialogue. That natural resources are better thought of as relatives and teachers. Gratitude is essential. The universe is constantly in flux. Time is circular. Respect for diversity, equality, and justice is crucial. Spirit is in all things. And that human knowledge must be joined by a fearless trust in the unknowable mysteries of nature. Let us remember who we really are and reestablish our intended way of being with respect, generosity, gratitude, and of course, the happiness that comes from this. Metakwe Oyasi, we are all related.
Wow, thank you so much for that. I mean, that pretty much says it all. So from that, I would love to ask the question of what do you feel like the world needs more of right now?
Well, it needs more of, are less of anthropocentrism. So it needs more recognition of our interconnectedness. I define spirituality from an indigenous perspective. Really, I define it as doing exactly that, giving a sacred recognition of the significance and the magic and beauty of everything on in nature. Mm-hmm. I think that once we look down on any of nature's forms, and that includes rocks and the ocean, yeah, you know, and cockroaches. Once we do that, it sets the stage for the hierarchy that we're seeing. 72% approximately of all countries now are being led by right-wing dictators, and the United States is about to be next. We're in a situation where if we don't recognize that we are a part of nature. There was a time, not long ago, I'm ashamed to say, maybe 25 years ago, I thought that humans were a cancer on this planet. Mm. But, you know, I know better now. I know that we are a child of Mother Nature, just like the other creatures, you know, the octopus and the pelicans. And yet we have the imagination to be able to diverge. You know, the Hopi and the Maya and other indigenous cultures I've studied, they actually think this has happened three times before. And the first time Mother Nature responded by saying, hey, this isn't going to work, and with a fire, destroyed everything. And the next time it was an ice age, and the next time it was a flood. Mm-hmm. And they're saying that we are at the end of a fourth one, and that we have only seven chances, you know, opportunities. Now, who knows, you know, the seven chances, if, you know, in this mythology could be right. 18,000 years or a million years, whoever knows, right? But that's just, you know, that's just their way of saying that we have this potential. If people go to worldviewliteracy.org and download our worldview chart, you'll see 50 worldview precepts. And these worldview precepts are contrasting with between the dominant and the indigenous, the pre-colonial and the colonial. And we don't look at them as a good and bad. We look at them as a continuum. We all have both of them, right? And it's like left and right brain hemispheres. We are so out of balance on the colonial side. The genocide that's happening in Gaza is an ultimate example of that. And so what we want to do is we want to start looking at these worldview precepts. This is the way, and in our last, you had asked about books, my book, Restoring the Kinship Worldview, from University of Notre Dame, Darshan Narvaez, and it's also on Audible. Restoring the Kinship Worldview introduces 28 of these 50 precepts, and it introduces them by an indigenous voice. And then,
what was that book called? Just so people can
remember. It's called Restoring the Kinship Worldview.
Oh, that's the book I have. I love that.
Yeah. Indigenous voices introduced to it. And it has the 40 of the 50, you know, in the chart, but we only talk about 28 of them. But this is something practical that people can do. Mm. You know, you can sit down, I'm looking at my chart now, and you know, they can say, okay, so how much am I on this dominant colonial side of living my life with hierarchy and rigid hierarchy? Mm. Maybe I don't believe in it, but is my place of work, is my social, what I'm, you know, compared to, you know, an egalitarian culture? How much of courage and fearless trust am I operating on based on a fear-based thoughts and behaviors? So low respect for women versus high respect for women. And really kind of getting in and just looking at all of them and not missing any of them. Use of trance-based learning versus, you know, not doing it at all. And we have, if you go to Worldview Literacy and download the chart for free and then study it for 10 minutes a day, come back in 3 months, and answer our research questionnaire. And we're getting some pretty cool responses back. Like one person said, I didn't think this would do much, but my daughter and I kind of went over this every morning for quite a while. And it's like a cheat sheet for getting back to balance or something like that.
This is amazing. Yeah. So basically you're saying go to the worldliteracy.org.
Yeah, worldliteracy.org. And you can watch all the videos of Darshan and I talking But you can download in Spanish, in German, and in English, and then put it on your wall.
Yes, you know? This is a great tool. So everyone listening, go get their downloadable copy of this and use it as a tool of how to actually get in touch with the indigenous side. Yeah, this is the life systems on planet Earth. So the worldview chart for rebalancing life systems on planet Earth. This is such a beautiful tool, Four Arrows. I'm so grateful that you mentioned this because these are the tangible things that I think sometimes in our world, you know, these global problems are so big and they're so daunting. And it's like, what can I do in my little small world, in my small part to have an impact? And so I love this tool to have that as just a daily practice of going, okay, how am I gonna make this part of my world more? So please, everyone, we're gonna put the link below this episode. Please go get that so that you can start to really understand your role and your involvement, because we all have a role. For me, it starts with waking up every single day and choosing love, you know, choosing to actually align with that power that is us, that is the essence, and that is the action of how we want to move through the world. And then you have practices that are, you know, in alignment with that. And this is a great, beautiful practice to add to your life. So thank you for sharing that with us. I think
I would add that the one or two of the precepts relate to trance-based learning. Hmm. That we have all three Abrahamic religions say that hypnosis is of the devil. And so, and people have it on in Hollywood and they don't see it. They don't give it a lot of credibility. I had a book that was written 22 years ago called Patient Communication for First Responders about the natural hypnosis that happens during fear. And that's been revised. And I said, you better put the word hypnosis in it this time. It's called Hypnotic Communication in Emergency Medical Settings for Life-Saving and Therapeutic Outcomes. We're in a world of fear. And during times of fear, people become hyper-suggestible to the communication of a perceived trusted authority figure.
100%.
And this is why we're in trouble, right? And so as you look at this worldview chart, remember that, okay, you might decide, well, I am going to really start focusing more of being bonded to the land instead of being detached from it. Mm. Well, just saying that isn't enough. You got to go into a slight meditative state, going into alpha, which is everybody can do. Mm-hmm. And there's ways to do it. Get a play with a pendulum. If you can get a pendulum going by itself with the ideomotor neurons, you're in alpha, because it won't happen without alpha. And if you keep it going while you're imagining, I'm going to start getting more in touch with the land around me. Mm-hmm. It'll happen via the phenomenon of hypnosis. It's the most underrated concept in the world. So make sure
it's tapping back into the innate wisdom that we all hold in our intuition. But what happens is we're not using these tools and it's almost like a muscle that needs to be flexed. And so, you know, all of this amazing, powerful, unlimited potential is within all of us, but we're not understanding how do we tap into it. And so instead we go into this fear response. So yes, I love this. And there's so much practice that can be implied in this. And also I just think you have to, if you're listening to this episode, you have to just come down and hang out with us in Mexico and we can do all of this and be swimming in the bioluminescence of the ocean. I have to tell you, actually, you brought that up earlier. I have to tell you about my experience of that this fall, that honestly, it was the most spiritual night I've ever, ever, ever had on the ocean. And I was there with a friend in my tiny little beach house that you know, and we had gone to dinner and we came back and I was like, let's go take a walk on the beach. And actually my friend was kind of like, yeah, whatever. But I was like, well, I do that every night. So I'm going, and they came with me and we ended up walking. And all of a sudden I was dragging my foot in the sand and I looked down, it was like a flashlight turned on and I looked down and I was like, oh my God, my foot is neon green. And so I did it again. I dragged my foot and I was like, oh my God, what is going on? And literally I've never, ever, ever seen the bioluminescence this powerfully strong. I mean, it was like the whole sand underneath me was all green. So then I dropped down to my knees because I was so overwhelmed by this. And I started painting sand as like sand painting. Oh, and I was drawing and it was these beads of neon green that wouldn't stop. And I literally felt like, and I was saying to my friend, I'm like, I feel like I'm inside Avatar right now. Like it literally is like dropping down into that magical world of Avatar. And so I was down on the ground forever in the sand. And then the ocean was pretty strong. And so I was like, God, it'd be so cool to get in the water. Like, I want to swim. I want to see what this is. And at that moment, it was the craziest thing. We walked a little bit further. The ocean completely calmed. And I was just, like, you've got to be kidding me. So we jump into the ocean. I mean, we were naked because we didn't even have time to prepare for any of this. I was thinking we were just going on a beach walk. We run into the ocean and we become neon beings, just basking. And as you move your arms, it's like all of the beads are just radiating around you. And you're like a glow stick. You know, imagine
that's how,
those.
That's how it was that night.
Yes. Oh,
I can't tell you how glad I am that you shared that story. You know what it made me think of that I haven't thought of since 1968?
What?
I was in the Marine Corps at Pensacola, Florida, and I had been playing the piano in a place illegally called Trader John's in a movie called The Officer and the Gentleman with Richard Gere.
That Richard Gere, about right.
Well, yeah, and you know Richard Gere is working with us with a
Of course.
And in that movie he was in, they used Trader John's, although he told me it wasn't the real Trader John's, it was a fake one someplace in some other state. And it was off limits for military personnel, and I was an officer, and I was playing piano there. And I got pretty drunk. And I went back to the beach house. My buddy Brian was upstairs in the beach house. And I was too, I went to sleep and I didn't, you know, I don't drink much, but that's not especially now, but you know, I was an ex-Marine. I mean, I was a Marine, right? And so I'm drunk and I couldn't sleep. I was spinning. So I went out on the beach behind us. And exactly the same thing that you just described happened to me, except I did one crazy thing. I'm down writing my name and playing with it. And I go, And I noticed that if I was in the same place, you couldn't do it again. You had to go to a fresh spot.
Right, right.
And so I got to show my buddy this. This is the most amazing thing. And I had never seen my bioluminescence before.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was from Missouri. I wasn't here. Yeah. And so I go and I get, okay, I got to share this with my loving brother. So I take a big, fresh hunk of the wet sand and I go upstairs and I kick his bed and I say, Brian, you got to see this. And I went and sand all over him. Of course, nothing. But in 5 minutes, I convinced him. And him and I were like kids out playing the sand.
No, it is. It's one of the most magical. I literally, it's the top, for sure, top two magical experiences I've ever experienced. And it, what I love is it gave me hope. I think this is the word that I was in. I felt like I was inside hope. Hope for humanity, hope for planet Earth, that we still have a chance to honor and rebuild and bring this back around. Because I literally was like, this is too magical. I mean, the world is still a magical place and we have this ability to nurture this land and this home that we call planet Earth. And so anyways, it was so cool. I love that night.
I don't know if you're going to be happy with me offering this ending to our presentation.
Yeah.
And maybe I should actually end it with a quick flute song about seeing the beauty in the world that you're talking about. Because what I'm going to say now, I said to a group of people when I was at University of British Columbia about 3 years ago, and they went from loving me to hating me.
No. Let's do that.
All right.
Before we do that, I want to ask you one question. So I want, or not even a question, but I want you to fill in this blank. I am
a spirit inhabiting a container, a body that I was gifted to experience this beautiful, amazing, magical planet.
Thank you for that. And then fill in this blank. Love is.
Love is just a word. Loving is an action that we must live by.
Mm, thank you. Okay. So now let's move into your all of the things you want to close out here.
Well, when you bring up hope, I'm going to ask folks to consider redefining it as it from what it's usually meaning. It usually means things are going to turn out okay. I hope that this is going to, everything's going to be all right. We're going to turn things around. And I was asked that up at UBC and it just came out of me. I said, well, I don't personally think we're going to turn things around. And you could just feel the energy from like just, they really were loving what
from
I was
hope
saying.
To, yeah.
And they, why are you here? Why are you doing this work if you don't have hope in that way? And I quoted from another book I wrote called Sitting Bull's Words for a World in Crisis. And somebody asked him, how can you continue to be so generous in the world and love so many people, including the enemy? And how can you be practicing your spirituality all the time and drawing and creating new songs. And when smallpox has wiped almost every of your people out and the buffalo gone, et cetera. And he said, I want to be a human being. And his definition, if he was to have been asked how to define hope, he would have said, hope's not the certainty for a good outcome. We've experienced that. This is the end of us. Hope is the certainty that what you're doing is the right thing to do, regardless of the outcome. So we've come full circle here. We started talking about fearlessness. And as long as we have, you know, at Standing Rock, people burned out, you know, having hope and then seeing what's happening. And it's getting worse and worse, although lots of people are awakening. So this is my statement. If you do that and you realize that someone's going to, whatever happens, people will, you use the word rebuild, but it's going to get bad. And to hope that it won't keeps you from really doing as much as you can. And people have written me since then saying, you know, I'm not burning out anymore since I've taken on that definition. And so, you know, I want people to rebuild with the vibrational frequencies that your program puts out.
Yeah. So but say it one more time so that we can really take it
on. So hope is a certainty that what you're doing is the right thing to do, regardless of the outcomes.
Every day.
Yeah. And just continue doing that. And then when you start to see, wow, you know, things are getting worse in the government. Things are getting worse with genocide. Things are getting worse with ecological devastation. There's a good chance, and I'm not saying it's impossible, there's a good chance that, things are going to get much worse. And recognizing that and continuing with the spirit.
Doing your part.
Because everything is vibrations. And if you look at the post-apocalyptic movies that are out there, they all start with people doing the bad things that got them in trouble in the first place.
Yeah.
Let's get the vibrations of your podcast.
Yeah.
The kind of work that so many people are awakening to, right? Those vibrations, which are still in the great minority in terms of the power of action in the world.
Yeah.
Let's get that happening, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And like the Cherokee Trail of Tears, that was what I was going to say, you know, the ending with the flute. They sang a song. The women sang a song. Women are always the leaders. And that's how it is. That's one of the worldview precepts. And that's why women don't pierce in the Sundance. You guys already have this power. Right. Us men keep forgetting it. And we have to do this. The piercing.
Thank you for honoring that.
Well, I mean, and that's something that we pray on the third round of our lodge, if you recall.
I know.
Yeah. And so on this Trail of Tears, this forced march, which was as horrible as anything that we can be imagining. It was a genocide. It was horrible. And only a small percentage survived it. Every night, the women would sing a lullaby to children, even if the mother of the child had died. It was the women took over. And it was, Carlos Nakai taught this to me. And the words, I wish I could sing them in Cherokee and translate them, but it goes something like this. But did you see the animals in the clouds and how the clouds are still keeping their responsibility by giving us this fresh rain? And did you see the dancing grasses in the field and how they're dancing with the wind and furnishing the food for the four-leggeds that are helping us survive? And did you see the beautiful fish in the creek when we crossed it and how it's keeping its water clean? And as you hear the wonderful sounds of the mockingbird and how that's teaching us our song. And I kept going with,
wow,
kind of the horrors of around us. Did you see that? And not only did you see the beauty of it and the magic of it, but how it's keeping its responsibility to help others, right? And so let me just play it as we
Please. Thank you so much for all of your energy and work that you're doing in the world.
Thank you, too. And I can't wait to see you in person again.
Yes.
Kewa Chiankinte. Here it goes. Imagine what the mother is singing and saying. Thank you.
My heart is full of gratitude. Thank you so much for being who you are and doing everything you do in the world. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for joining us on Came Here to Love. I hope today's conversation has inspired you to live more fully, align with your soul, and spread more love in the world. Remember, love is the highest vibration, and when we lead with it, we elevate not just our own lives, but the lives of those around us. If today's episode resonated with you, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, or share it with someone who could use a little more love in their life. And as always, keep tuning in for more heart-centered conversations that remind us all why we are here to love. Until next time, keep living your light and loving with your whole heart.